Good morning, everyone. Namaste. Today, I would like to share with you two passages from a course which was perhaps structured maybe almost 100 years ago. And it's quite pertinent, these two passages, to the teaching. And thereafter, I will read out an email that I received asking some questions. And then we will open the floor up for discussion. Because an action or opinion does not coincide with our standards of behavior, let us not allow ourselves to take such notice of it that we immediately desire to rush in and resist it. Let us mind our own business and not permit the incident, whatever it may be, to get under our skin and cause us to be irritated. Not by what the other person does, but because of our own antagonism to it. The irritation will be our own if we permit it, and we shall suffer, not the other fellow. We must practice every moment of the day, seeing everyone we meet in the light. With our inner eye, we must see through all appearances to the true self of others, which is in reality our own self in them. This reminds me of when someone asked the Buddha, who was walking with the Buddha, and he came across a man who started abusing the Buddha with vile and vicious abuses. And the Buddha kept still. And then after that man exhausted his abuses, he walked away from the Buddha. So Buddha's disciple asked him that how come you didn't react? How did you stay so calm? So Buddha said, look, it's very simple. Supposing someone gives you a gift and you don't take it, you don't accept that gift, the gift stays with the giver of the gift. Similarly, when someone abuses you, if you don't take delivery of it, it stays with the abuser. Not taking delivery of it, not letting it get under our skin. Because as I read out, any antagonism, any irritation towards the other appears like it is towards the other, but it is arising in our own consciousness. So as this says, the other fellow has really nothing to do with it. In fact, whatever irritates you regarding what someone else does is actually your own issue. It takes courage to accept this fact. In some way, no matter how subtle or how blatant, you know what that feeling is yourself because you have done it in some form or the other. That is the honest truth, the naked truth. For example, supposing there is a pushy personality and you resist such a personality. We all have such personalities in our lives, people who are pushy. Firstly, we have to know what it is to be pushy in order to recognize it. We may not have been made to be pushy like the other person, but in our own way, in our own subtle ways, we have been pushy ourselves. Otherwise, we would not be able to recognize that quality, you see. This is the maya. This is the illusion that it appears others are doing things to us. And so our guns are always targeted at the others. We, of course, are never to blame. So we have to be very careful when we accuse and judge people for something they are supposed to have done. Because truly, we are accusing and judging ourselves. Now, the mind can come in and analyze this avital kingdom come. No, but, no, I don't agree with this. No, this is this, therefore that is that. What you're saying is right, what you're saying is wrong. Either that, or why not trust that guides, teachers, masters, they only have your best intentions at heart. Their only wish is to make life simpler through clarity. They are not here to complicate your life even more. This trust is what Nisargadatta Maharaj would emphasize on. He would say, trust me. My only intention for you is to help you see reality for what it is. I have no other intention. And so he would emphasize on trust and earnestness. Earnestness is the key. Because the mind has its limitations. The mind can keep saying yes, but, yes, but, yes, but. Surrender to the Guru. Surrender to consciousness means the mind surrenders itself to the feet of consciousness because it has accepted that it cannot make sense of everything that happens in life. That is the surrender. When traditionally in India, students and disciples would bow down to their master, at the feet of the master, they are surrendering their mind, their egoic mind, to the feet of the source. But to some people, it looks like, oh my God, he's given his power away to the Guru. How can he do that? How can the Guru encourage that? The Guru, a true Guru, will never ask someone to touch their feet, you see. It's just a spontaneous arising of gratitude, you may call it. Surrender to a higher force. The Guru does not give a damn, frankly. But the symbolism behind it. The next thing I would like to read out. In our relations with others, we must first learn the greatest of all practices, that of non-recognition. We learn not to recognize what appear to be failings and weaknesses in others, for by doing so, we admit that there exists in our own consciousness the very thing we condemn in them. We must never forget that all motives spring from a spiritual seed planted in the individual by divine love. I will repeat the last sentence. We must never forget that all motives spring from a spiritual seed planted in the individual by divine love. What does this mean in simple terms? Whatever anyone does is because they love themselves. It is because of love. The love may be to protect myself because I love myself. You see? So everyone's motive is the same. What has happened is there has been a misconception based on separation that has got generated in the process. But the motive is love. That's what binds us all together. That is why we can't bear seeing people suffer on television. When you see right now in India, all we see is videos of hospitals with not only patients in them, dead bodies wrapped up. And one feels it. Why? Love. So even people who are rude to you, for example, why are they rude? Because they love themselves and they feel threatened. Love. The default setting is love. It is the veil of illusion that actually has to be drawn aside. Do you know that is actually a practice, a yogic practice? I can't go into it deeply, but this action, the clearing of the eyes of duality, drawing the veil of illusion apart, this is what the teachings are doing. Clear seeing. Okay. Does wisdom create more suffering? Wisdom cannot create more suffering. But wisdom does create more awareness of suffering. That is why it is wisdom. So many of us are unconsciously suffering, just stuck in this dream of old habits and patterns and dislikes and blame and condemnation without knowing it. Wisdom is when something steps in and brings this to your awareness that, look here, this is what is going on. Take a look. How can wisdom enhance? So this is a long question. I will read it out in parts. After learning that everything is predetermined, that not a particular leaf from a particular garden at a particular time can move without the will of God, this shakes me up. When I look back, that God willfully planned all this suffering for me. We are looking at God as an individual. God, you planned this for me. When the teaching is always pointing to the totality, the consciousness that includes all the polaric opposites of every conceivable kind. Now, some people are destined for more suffering than others. Let's take someone who is blind. That is the destiny. So in his or her case, one can say God has planned more suffering for them. This is what the mind tries to do, you see. It tries to make sense of the destiny. How can God do this to me? I can't understand why God can give me so much pain. There are so many people living below the poverty line who are suffering infinitely more. But the mind cannot accept that God doesn't like me. God has given me more suffering than he should have. Why is my life more pain and less pleasure? This is the entitled mind. It is understandable at one level because one can surely get frustrated and tired of the suffering in one's life. But the teaching is an invitation to look at this in a different light, to be aware of things, to be aware of how the mind is slipping into the victim story. Why does the mind do that? If God is pure consciousness, impersonal, like the sun, who is asking these questions? Who is saying, why has God given me more suffering? Why has God given me wisdom? It's enhancing my suffering. All that is the thinking mind. If you put two people together who have a large amount of suffering in their lives, and I'm not saying this lightly, it's just to show one aspect, one point of human nature. It's quite possible when they get together, they will start discussing whose suffering is more. No, this is what I have been through. You don't know what I have been through. And then the other person will say, you don't know what I have been through. Because the ego is identified with the suffering and now says, my suffering is greater than yours. So, yes, it can be exhausting when for a long span of time you find things not going your way. It can be very tiring. That is bound to happen if, let's say, there is one setback after another. What does one do? I remember one line from a song by Alan Parsons. The game never ends when your whole world depends on the turn of a friendly card. The game never ends when your whole world depends on the turn of a friendly card. Of course, life is not always a bed of roses. It is sometimes pleasure, sometimes pain. This breaks me even more to realize that I am constantly on a bed of thorns and pain. That is life for many people. Either we are dancing on coals or we are walking on broken glass, trying to navigate our journey through life. And it is so relative, you see. Now, for example, let's assume you sleep at night. Now, I will tell you a first-hand example of a friend of mine who was in the police force. He was at a senior position. And he had two young boys who were at the age where you party in the night, come home late. And what used to happen sometimes, the telephone would ring at 12 a.m. and a stranger would be on the line. These were the days before mobile phones. And he would talk to the cop and say, please come down fast. Your son has met with an accident just now. And it's very close to your building. So just come out of your building immediately. No, he was not impulsive. So he put the phone down, made a few inquiries, and found out it was a hoax call by someone who wanted to shoot him when he stepped out of his building. And he said to me, he said, Gautam, all through my children's growing up years, this is what used to happen. It was like living on the edge, that phone which rings in the night. Is it true? Is it false? So, obviously, it would mean sleepless nights. He didn't want to stop his children from stepping out. But as a parent, given the role he was playing, he was walking on broken glass. So the point I'm trying to make here is everything is relative to each person's individual experience. There is no point in comparing our life experience with others, because that comparison gives sustenance to the ego. Everyone has their stories of suffering. Some are more obvious than others. We saw a rich young Bollywood star recently, highly successful, who took his life because of depression. So one may not have known it. The degree of suffering sometimes is subtle and invisible to the outside world, you see. So this comparing is a beautiful pastime of the thinking mind. Is the law of attraction for real? That means I am attracting and asking for pain from the universe, but nobody does anything, so I may not be asking for suffering. Why is this negativity still following me? I think this question is not clear, but the main point of the question is, am I attracting and asking for this pain? But if nobody does anything, I may not be asking for it. And therefore, why is it following me? Negativity is not a person who is following us, based on what we are doing and not doing, you see. It is a circumstance, an event in life which is perceived as negative. If you say, I am not doing anything, so why is negativity following me? That is not the right understanding. If events are meant to come your way, as per destiny, the will of God, the divine plan, to accept that it was meant to come, that is the teaching. Ramana Maharshi has said it is all based on one's prarabdha, the karma from the past. Maharaj has said the unexpected seldom happens. The unexpected always happens. The expected seldom does. It is not a question of us doing anything in order to attract negativity into our lives. It is our attitude to life. Our attitude to what happens to us, you see. If I just witness this pain, observe it, or leave it unattended, why does it get stretched in time and goes on for several days in the background. Because you have not left it unattended. This teaching brings about the end of psychological pain, not physical pain. It is the psychological pain which is getting stretched in the duration of time. If I just witness this pain, observe it, or just leave it unattended, why does it get stretched in time? Because you have not witnessed it. You have not left it unattended. You may think you have, but if there is psychological involvement in the situation, in the pain, then that is not witnessing. And that involvement may happen based on our conditioning, our genetics. But what happens is we then get involved in the involvement. That is what the ego does. You see how the ego compounds the problem and builds layers and layers and layers upon it. And now it says, I should not have got involved. First was the pain. Then there was psychological pain. Then the ego says, I should not have got involved with the psychological pain. This goes on endlessly. This is the suffering of the ego. This perpetuates the drama that is me and my story. If God chose suffering for me, why did He give me wisdom and entangle it more? How can wisdom entangle it more? It is perhaps an improper understanding that has created more entanglement. How can wisdom, when the whole wisdom is there to lighten your load. Wisdom is there. In fact, it is suffering that leads us to wisdom. And now, how can wisdom lead us to more suffering? A loss in life, whether it is a partner, whether it is an object, whatever it may be, a loss in life makes us turn inward. Many people's journey begins with loss. Either I lost all my money, I lost my relationship. Because one has seen that life is temporary, transient, fleeting. Objects cannot be relied on. That is the beginning of wisdom. Now, how can that wisdom create more suffering? It's not possible. Suffering is the absence of wisdom. This male is just me and my story. Once we drop I from the statements, we feel better. But the point is, why is my story looking like this? Why not others known to me? Why don't they have similar back-to-back non-stop intense events? In the name of karma. Is there some technique or process that can help to match my planets with worldly success? If you find out, please let me know. Having said that, I must point out one aspect of this teaching. You see, supposing the teaching gets stuck at an intellectual level, nobody truly does anything. You have accepted it intellectually. That, of course, this makes sense. I have understood everyone is shaped by their genetics and their conditioning, and so they truly don't do anything in the sense they are shaped by the divine, by God, like that. That is the intellect accepting that position. Some people may reject it outright. I don't buy this. This concept does not appeal to me. I hold everyone accountable. So in that case, the intellect has rejected this concept. Now, after accepting it intellectually, it doesn't mean the game is over. Is the teaching being lived? What words are you using? What thoughts are in the mind? Are those based on doership? It could still be that the teaching is intellectual, but the rest of it, it has had no impact on. So for example, if you say, you know, so-and-so member in my staff, in my factory, acted tough, and so we bashed him up. What does that reveal? What are the words that reveal? What is the vibration you are carrying, even though you have accepted it intellectually? What is the dialogue in your head? If you accept nobody truly does anything, are you still accusing and blaming and condemning people? Let us be true to ourselves. Let us be honest with ourselves. Now, if that is happening, all that is needed is witnessing that, oh yes, my God, I've understood this whole concept intellectually. It really appeals to me. It does make my life simpler, but I find that I'm still playing out old patterns in my speech, in my thoughts, in my dialogue, especially with loved ones whom I take for granted. I still blame them as if they have done things. I still accuse them. Only witnessing of this is required, because it brings it into awareness. Once again, the teaching shines light on it. But now it is an invitation to look at your dialogue, because your dialogue is your vibration. The compulsive thinking in one's mind is one's vibration. Take a look. And it is that witnessing without judging. Oh God, I should not be like that. That is all judging. Forget it. Witnessing that I can really see this. I can see I accept the teaching, but I'm still doing all this. That witnessing makes the teaching sink deeper and deeper and deeper. Because after all, you are also doing it based on your past condition. See how graceful and all-embracing this teaching is. It accepts you precisely the way you have been made. It is not criticizing, it is not judging, it is not condemning. It is just constantly shining a light on whatever is happening right now, without or within. The nature of light is to shine. That's all it does. Okay. So we will now see if there are any questions anyone has. Yes, Shweta. Yes, Jaren.
Good morning, Gautamji. So I'm attending this for the first time. I hope I'm audible.
Yes, yes.
So I have been, I've been listening to your talks, and then I have read a couple of your articles as well. So there is this theme of not taking on the doership, and about accepting what is coming your way. You know, there's that, you know, destiny. We were talking about this destiny also right now in the earlier answer. So when I don't take this doership, I'm just afraid, you know, like anything that's happening around, even if a person is committing the mistake knowingly, you know, trying to cause suffering for his own selfish needs, or if I see something happening, you know, that sense of, okay, this is happening because, for example, now the COVID situation is going on, I see people suffering. So then, you know, that thought of, maybe I can't do anything, this is what is supposed to happen. You know, when you're actually capable of doing something, but you think, okay, if it is, if things are supposed to improve, they'll improve by themselves. You know, that sense of that motivation to do something, I see that decreasing, and you know, becoming more passive because of this sense of there's nothing in my hand, it will happen the way it has to. So where am I going wrong in understanding this non-doership?
Thank you, Shweta. You see, this teaching says that one should do exactly what is in one's nature to do. So if your nature is to do something about it, you are honoring that nature. I have always given this example, which my guru used to give decades ago, when there was a program on TV where whales were being slaughtered, and two very famous people saw that program. One was J. Krishnamurti, and the other one, I think, was Brigitte Bardot, or a very famous Hollywood personality at that time. Now, this personality, this Hollywood personality, was tremendously moved by the suffering of the whales. And she thought, I'm popular, I have the money, I'm going to start a Save the Whales movement. And she was very successful. On the other hand, Krishnamurti, when he saw the same program, was aghast. And being of a timid nature, being the quiet type, he could not bear to see what he saw. So he got up and switched off the TV. So each person did what is in their nature to do. So with this teaching, it does not mean that Brigitte Bardot would have said, oh, I'm not the doer, I can't do anything, so I'm going to sit back passively and not do anything. Because that is not the nature. You see, that is the misunderstanding which the ego, with its sense of doership, has now acquired. I was doing something, now I should not be doing it because the teaching says one is not the doer. Whereas it is the opposite. It is the opposite, because the doing becomes more and more natural, more and more enjoyable. If it is one's nature to do things, one can really bloom and blossom in that. Why? Because now it is happening without an expectation of an outcome, firstly. It is being done for the joy of doing it. Why? Because it's the nature. I am truly not doing it. I have been made that way. And that is why the sage is called a Mahabhogi, a super enjoyer, because whatever is being done in the moment, he is enjoying it because he is not doing it. So this has to be looked at. This passivity which you speak about, which seems to be seeping in, why is it coming? What is the reason for it? That is something only you would know. But what I would like to correct here is that do not mistake accepting that whatever happens as God's will to be passive. In fact, it makes one more alive and vibrant than one is. Because now you are going forward without all barriers and protective coverings, and facing life. So this needs to be looked at. Okay? Do we have Jaren here, or has he disappeared?
Oh, I'm still here. No. So I can see that thoughts, when mind is creating thoughts, is disturbed, that creates barriers. It seems to narrow consciousness. But how about feelings? So if we say abiding in being, is it in fact the same as abiding in feeling?
It depends, Jaren, because what is the feeling based on?
Well, I seem to arrive, if there's no thought, there's still feeling. There's continuous feeling. So.
Yes, but the feeling will be based on a thought. Abiding in being means pure presence. Now, if a feeling arises within that, that will be based on a thought. What happens is, when that thought is not stretched in the duration of time, then the feeling stays as the feeling. That is why some people can operate from feeling, because the thinking mind has not got entangled in that feeling. So feeling in that sense is purer, you could say, because it has not got distorted by the movement of thought into thinking. And so you can feel situations. Let's say you are at a party and you meet people and you feel someone's energy, you feel I'm more comfortable with this person. You've not exchanged words, so the thought has not gone into thinking. So you're operating from feeling, which is a beautiful space to operate from in life. You see, all our emotions and feelings are in our, what is traditionally called the Manipur Chakra, which is, you can say, the solar plexus and below. That is the intuitive brain. The intestines are shaped like the brain. We all know that. People who can sense their feelings because they are not muddled up with the web of thoughts become more intuitive. They feel their way through situations. They feel their way through decisions. So in that sense, to have that awareness, what am I feeling now, is a beautiful space to be. But it is not the same as abiding in one's being. Abiding in one's being is abiding in one's being.
So taking distance from feeling as well, actually.
Abiding in one's being is complete. It holds the space for everything. So even if the feeling is there, it is witnessed. So yes. The feeling is not the abiding in one's being. The feeling is also a movement which is witnessed. So one could say abiding in one's being is even prior to that. This feeling has arisen.
Yes.
That awareness is abiding in the being. And when nothing arises, no thought, no feeling, nothing to witness, what happens is one slips into non-witnessing, which is the start of what is referred to as samadhi.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. Thank you.
Okay. Yes, Harish.
It's me. Hi, Gautam.
Yes, Roshni. You have an angel on your shoulder.
Yeah. Surrounded all the time by lovely angels, and one of them is you. After hearing your talks, you know, it's like I remember the first time that I heard you, and this notion of God's will was like completely no to me, but now slowly it's like sinking in me, and I kind of let go of it. The resistance that happens, I kind of let go of it. But from today's talk, there are two things that I want to clarify. I want an explanation. One is when you said that what we see in others is their personality is a part of us. because it is in us that so we see in others. I want you to explain a little bit more. And secondly, is that what you said about witnessing and awareness and intellectual and actually the knowledge sinking in. There's a lot of turmoil. There's a lot of resistance. There's a lot of struggle. There's a lot of pain that goes on because it is the ego that is crashing. It is something new versus what I'm always doing as in response, as in reaction, letting it be as to always fighting for what is right, or this is meant to happen because it's God's will and I'm meant to crush the notions or the ego or my old conditioning. And so there's so much of hodgepodge that is going on. So when you said all these things about intellectual and what is being imbibed, the discrepancy between the two, I mean, I just burst out crying because it's so much of a struggle that is happening in me. And sometimes I just think I'm going nuts with, this kind of resistance that's happening. So I just wanted to, share. And also it's very, there's a lot of, there's a lot of awareness after, of acceptance of one's nature also, because after your talks, like, there are different kind of people with different suffering and some are timid and some are this. So I'm not judging myself so harshly like I used to, because I was always judging myself that I'm a very, scared or a timid person. So it's very relieving also to know that they're all kind of people, and because of conditioning and genetics or past karma or whatever. So there is a big bhel puri out of all these things. So I need for you to sort things out, please.
See, Roshni, firstly, fundamentally, there are only two or three main pointers of this teaching. One is the acceptance of God's will. And basically, it means a will higher than one's individual will. Some people are not comfortable with the word God. That is the first point. The second is that nobody truly does anything. If you accept these two, even intellectually, if it makes sense to you, then that means the teaching has appealed to you. So you have to be clear that, have I accepted these two tenets of this teaching? If the answer is no, then no amount of convincing is going to work. But if you even accept that, yes, part of me accepts it, part of it makes sense, that is the opening up of the ego with its sense of worship to accept that, yes, this makes sense, which I think has happened with you. Otherwise, you would not be drawn to this teaching again and again and again. The main thing is, to tackle the first point, let's say you call someone by an attribute, like this person gets very jealous. I've noticed this quality in this person. Jealousy arises easily. In fact, Roshni, I'll tell you how strange human nature is. Someone told me that when she got married, her husband gave her a ring before the marriage and she went to show it to her mother. Now, what would one think? That the mother would be delighted. Such a beautiful ring my daughter has got. Do you know that in a week's time, the mother got her own ring and told the daughter, see this ring, it's better and bigger than what your husband gave you. Even that happens. Look at human nature. So, jealousy, we were talking about jealousy. Now, if you are aware that someone is a jealous person by nature, two things happen here. One is now you have the understanding that based on that person's conditioning, jealousy happened as an attribute. Okay? But the other thing is that you must also know what jealousy is, what it is to be jealous in some small way or the other, because then only can you recognize it in the other. You see? So anything that you see in others is your first-hand experience, even though it may be covert, it may be in a very sublime way, not so obvious as what you see it in the other person. But you have to know it, otherwise you would not recognize it. So this beautiful thing happens with this teaching. You may still say, oh, this person is jealous, because that is your old conditioning. But now with the teaching you have seen, and my God, you know, I can now see jealousy as an attribute which this person has based on events not in his or her control. That is the first thing which happens. The second thing is that word jealous, the thought jealous, is arising only in your own consciousness. Jealous, jealous. And you know the meaning of the word jealous. So with this understanding, compassion arises. That this person can't help but be jealous based on factors I know nothing about. Their conditioning, how their parents treated them. This is what starts happening with this teaching. So you may still react with old patterns and old conditioning because it is so strong. But suddenly the understanding will kick in, my God, what's going on here? Earlier, it was all unconscious behavior, which was perpetuating the suffering. Now this light has been thrown on it. It looks like it is amplifying it even more.
Yes.
But what is actually happening is it is brought to your awareness. Earlier, it was suffering perpetuating itself unconsciously, nonstop.
Yeah.
The gift of any spiritual teaching is that it shines light on it. So the ego gets shaken up. It will certainly get shaken up because now it's not in its comfort zone of blaming and accusing others or itself. That comfort zone has gone. Why? Because grace has stepped in. The light of understanding has stepped in. The ego will still try to push, nudge, react, because getting thrown off now wiggles like this. And the teaching comes in, the teaching comes in, the teaching comes in. So you will go through this churn, but as long as you have sensed, as long as the teaching has seeped in some way or the other, my God, I actually do accept this intellectually. Only now I'm hoping and wishing that it translates into daily living. That is a very noble wish, one could say, you see, because the recognition is there that this is the way to peace. So if you feel deep down that this teaching has really helped me relook at my relationships with others as well as myself, isn't that a gift? Or do you find you're blaming people more and you're hating people more?
No, that's not. It's just that the struggle is more within the old versus the new as in others. Yes. So it's like a constant.
That is a very natural process. That is what my teacher referred to as the flip-flop. That is the new conditioning transforming the earlier conditioning. And it takes time. Because we, you see, where we have been shaped most is in our childhood. All the conditioning we received in childhood has shaped up. Now, at this stage in life, this fresh dimension has come in to relook at everything. So that struggle will be there. It will get gradually with the light of clarity. That struggle will get less and less and less. And allow it to take its course. That is why I keep using that example where you've been given the driving license, but you're still full of fear if you're driving in heavy traffic from here to, let's say, Bandra or Juhu. But now you're driving for 2-3 years. And you look back and say, my God, 3 years ago, it was a real struggle for me to drive through heavy traffic, but now it's quite simple. So when you look back, you say, my God, this teaching actually changed my life and the way I look at things, the way I look at people, the way I see events in my life, it has changed. I may have felt it has not, but when I look back, I say, yeah, I'm really like, perhaps you could say a different person now. So that is what happens. So the struggle is natural.
But I'm not feeling as yet compassionate or something towards X or Y person. It's still, the distance is still there, but the internal thing is happening inside.
That's absolutely fine.
Is that a natural process until and unless it just sinks in?
Yes, these are all stages. These are all stages in development, growth. You can call it what you want. So everything doesn't have to follow a fixed blueprint that this must happen, this must happen, this must happen. You see, for someone, let's say, who's abused in life in the younger years, how can compassion come overnight? It's going to take time because the conditioning is that I should not trust anyone. I hate people who I don't know, and so on and so forth. Compassion, by and large, in what sense arises? Because now you can see, you truly can see, you know, that people who mean harm or say cruel words or whatever, you can actually see the burden they are carrying, which is propelling them to be like that. And the compassion is in knowing inside that this person must have suffered in life to make them the way they are now. That is what compassion is, more of the nature of an understanding. It doesn't mean you have to go and hug everyone and be compassionate if it's not your nature. Compassion is in the nature of the understanding. So you will see that happening.
Thank you, God. That's a big relief talking to you today. Thank you so much.
You know, this angel is, it always reminds me of, angels are actually very interesting because if whatever little I read in my younger years on angels, firstly, the wings of an angel. The wings are actually vibrations which emanate from the heart. And angels are supposed to be genderless, not male, not female. So the iconography is so beautiful because it actually shows a being, not a human, a being operating from the heart. And like yogis who have the vision can see that when someone operates from the heart, the vibration projects like this. Like literally, if you solidified that vibration, it would look like the person has wings. So these are not fancies and fantasies of, you know, certain people or cultures. Everything has such a deeply significant meaning. Not having a gender means what? It is pointing to the polaric opposites of male and female. The duality of life being centered. So not having a gender is symbolic of that neutral ground, the ground of being, the ground of being operating from the heart of understanding, the heart of love. So these are very beautiful symbols, and it's always nice to have them around the house, because unconsciously, you obviously resonate with it. You may not know why, but you may feel, I've always liked to have these things around the house. Or some ugly curio. Is that what you like having around the house? You see, so unconscious, subconscious thoughts can even present themselves like that. So we feel we have this object which gives us joy when we look at it. We may not know why we have it, but that has to be trusted. What is it? What is that which made me bring this kind of a curio in my house and which I like? There's a reason behind all these things, you see. That is the grace. That is the grace.
Thank you.
I know someone who, I went to someone's house, Roshni, and I was looking around, and in the bedroom, I went to the bedroom in order to use the restroom. I saw a painting which kind of made me feel not good, I could say. It was the painting of a head in an abstract way with a lot of crisscross brush strokes in a very violent way drawn, you know, like this whole thing. And when I looked at it, it kind of, I sensed some unease, and I said, my God, to be looking at this all the time in one's bedroom, you know, it kind of stayed in my mind. And so when I left that house, I asked the person who had taken me, and I was not surprised to find that schizophrenia runs in this family. And so perhaps this painting appealed to the host for reasons he may not know. And it was kept in the bedroom, if you please. So you see, what is around us gives us clues. Objects are symbols. One can really see so much in what is around people, because as without, so within. Okay, we have time, maybe 5 more minutes. Yes, Vandana.
Sorry, Gautam, I bother you every Sunday.
Not at all.
So I just wanted to find out, why are people so worried about their spiritual progress? I mean, how does it matter whether you progress or you regress as long as you're on the path?
That is what the ego does, you see. It wants an end result. That's actually, you've asked a very beautiful question. You know what? When my teacher wrote this book called The Ultimate Understanding, one of the first sentences in the book was, spiritual seekers are lost in a conceptual forest created by their own imagination. And someone wrote to me, I'm going back to the year 2001. Someone wrote to me saying they bought this book, they read the first line, and they loved it so much that they wrote it out 1,000 times. And I thought to myself that he has done exactly what the line says. You are lost in your forest so much that you've written that out 100 times. But you see, the earnestness is there, because the ego now has sensed there is such a thing as peace and I want it. So in one sense, it is a very good sign. But the ego being the ego thinks I can do something to hasten the progress. That sense of doership is the mischief maker. And that seeker who accepts that my spiritual progress will happen precisely the way it is designed to happen. Just as the teaching came to me as it was meant to. That seeker does not have this load and this weight of a projection into a future moment. So if a spiritual seeker accepts that I can't push this, no matter how much I want to, I have to accept it as the divine decree, and I relax in that acceptance, that seeker is truly blessed. Because after all, it is projecting an imaginary future by trying to get there, and there's no such thing. This is the future. This is the past. It is only now. So that is a seeker at rest who doesn't want to hasten the spiritual progress. Okay?
Thank you.
Beautiful. Yes, Rahul?
Good morning, Gautam.
Morning.
Something keeps me getting up for your talks every day. Something just kicks me in the morning because it's 7 o'clock here in Germany when your talks start. So by 6:50, it's like something kicks me and says, "Get up! It's a Zoom meeting with Gautam." So I thank
Rahul. Someone told me they actually get a kick. They don't know from where it comes, but they actually get a push in their bed and wake up. I don't know how far that's true or if it's imagination, but you see, what you are actually saying is it's not in your control.
I guess.
It's like a child who told his mother, this child was sneezing a lot. Achoo, achoo, achoo. So the mother got bugged beyond a point. So the mother told the child, "Stop sneezing." So the child said, "But mummy, I am not sneezing. It is sneezing me."
So Gautam, my question is, how do I get a hold of the teachings? Is there a book or...
There are books, there are videos, and let the teaching get hold of you is what I say.
Okay. So there's no like a starting point or...
Well, in terms of books, my first book is Pointers from Ramesh Balsekar, which I would recommend to anyone who resonates with what I say, because it's a very brief, I think maybe 50-page booklet rather, not even a book, which is a summary of the teaching. That would be the starting point. And the next is the Buddha Sword, which is again, it grows from that first book. So I would suggest if you enjoy reading, then by all means read these two books first. And of course there are many videos now on the net. So you can look at those anytime.
Yeah, okay. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, I think we have one more and then we call it a day. Yes, Laura. Laura?
Namaste, Gautam.
Namaste.
I'm really grateful for your teaching.
Thank you.
And I love your crows. And the parrots who talk to you through the window.
Yes. And sparrows too.
Yes. All the birds. And one time you got up and left the satsang because the crow was asking for water. And that's when I knew that you were my teacher.
So, I should keep up and giving crows water then.
Yeah, I love birds. I have a lot of birds around here too.
Oh, lovely. Where are you based, Laura?
I'm in the United States.
Okay.
So I've always had this problem with this paradox. At physical birth, we emerge from source, and the universe breathes life into us. And when the body dies, our vibrational form is absorbed back into source. And our entire lifetimes are embedded in the matrix of the universe, which is supported and structured by source. And when we meditate or just stay quiet, we can easily feel the living presence of that field that permeates everything. And yet, despite all of that, somehow the human mind is so clever that it continuously distracts and diverts us from our true nature. And we continuously fall into its tricks and traps. And could you talk about that paradox?
You see, Laura, that is the beauty of the human birth. To recognize that we are the only species who can recognize and separate ourselves from that. And that is why in the Indian traditions, they say it is a blessing to be gifted a human birth so that one can get out of the cycle of birth and death. And this cycle is nothing but what you have just mentioned, the antics of the thinking mind, the reincarnation. Forget about reincarnating lives upon lives. Is thought upon thought upon thought. We reincarnate into who we think we are, then we go back, then like that is the game which goes on. So to see the nature of the mind and know that it is the mind's nature to create this trouble, to create mischief, it is not about quietening that mind. It is to recognize the nature of the mind and the nature of my true self as apart from that. Because otherwise it can be a very frustrating journey to try and control this mind. And that is why Ramana Maharshi would always say, the only way is to turn away from the mind, not to try and suppress it, decondition it and work hard at it, to see that this is the nature of the mind and live one's life with that awareness. And actually, I would love to take this question of yours further in another talk, because it is so pertinent and you have expressed it so well. And unfortunately, we are running out of time, but truly, it may sound strange, but this is why we are gifted the suffering of the thinking mind, because the human is aware that he or she is aware. I am aware of being aware. That is my gift. That is why they say don't waste a human birth. Even traditionally, for example, suicide, which is a very different subject, they would say, don't waste the precious gift of the human birth, because with suicide, you're only dropping the physical body. All your turmoils are going to continue. So it's not the end to problems. So it is a gift. And the gift has been recognized, like you say. And the only thing is this mind, which does all this nonsense, which we will explore again. But thank you for that.
Thank you.
Yes, you have a beautiful gift of expressing clearly. Thank you.
Thank you.
A couple of things before we end is that, you see, the volunteers who are helping with this had a thought, and it reminded me of my days at my teacher's home, that once the satsangs were over, we would all spend 15, 20 minutes in his living room and get to meet each other from different parts of the world and so on, and made beautiful friendships. Some of them very meaningful because we had the common spiritual ground. So one thought was that from next Sunday onwards, the meeting room would be left open so people could interact with each other after I leave the room. So that's a personal preference. If you'd like to meet people and exchange notes, you're more than welcome to do that. That is one thing. The other thing I would like to say is that after the next Sunday's talk, we haven't really decided yet, but it does seem the talks will go on in July, because unfortunately, the situation is quite grim still here in Mumbai with the lockdown and with the cases rising. So in that sense, it's possible to have the Sunday talks. The talk after next Sunday will most likely be dedicated to the teachings of an Indian master called Shirdi Sai Baba. I had given many interviews on a channel called Sai Baba's Devotee Speaks, and many have been drawn to the teaching based on those interviews. So I am thinking of having one which fundamentally will be based on any questions which may come in regarding his teachings, which of course are valid for everyone. So that might happen. If you are on the mailing list, you will be informed about that. And yes, I think that's about it for today. So I will just change the screen so I can see all of you all, and we'll sit for a couple of minutes in silence.